Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Charlotte Greenspan. Greenspan is a musicologist, pianist, and author. She received a master's in music from the University of Illinois and a PhD from UC Berkeley. She has written extensively about music, opera, musical theater, and film. She recently published a book about an important but neglected figure in American musical theater. It's called Pick Yourself Up, Dorothy Fields and the American Musical. It is the second volume in a new series called Broadway Legacies, published by Oxford University Press. And welcome to the show, Charlotte.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
Now you spent much of your career writing about music, but you're also a trained pianist. You studied voice. Did you ever entertain any kind of a career in music and singing?
No. You know, if you grow up in New York City, whenever you start to play piano or to sing, there are people who started 5 years ahead of you who can do it, run rings around you. I started playing piano when I was 11, which maybe somewhere else wouldn't have been an old age to start. But in New York City, there were such accomplished 11-year-olds.
Uh-huh.
So
the city intimidated you from a career. That's interesting to me.
Well, I mean, I say that not knowing if I had any talent. I mean, well, you know, I could have.
Uh-huh. Well, what got you interested in musical theater? Tell us about that road.
Yes, well, when I started studying music in college, mm-hmm. You know, my parents had never gone to college. My parents had never gone to high school. And when I started, I was really interested in things that were very far from their world of experience. So I did Renaissance chanson, I did Italian opera, and then after my daughter was born, I thought, I want to do an American subject because I don't want to do primary work in European libraries.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to be with her
mm-hmm.
and with my husband. So I started thinking American topics, and it led back to the music of my parents, the music I heard them sing.
That's how it happened, huh? Now I know you actually had a particular interest in Irving Berlin's career. Now he was a contemporary of Dorothy Fields, and we're going to be discussing that book that you wrote that I mentioned in the introduction. Did he lead you to Dorothy Fields? How did you find her?
Well, her name is mentioned in assorted reference books, books on musical theater, books on film, and it was always a one-liner.
Hmm.
And I thought of doing something on Irving Berlin or on Cole Porter, but there's lots done on them already. I didn't know if I had something really new to contribute, although one always has one's point of view to contribute.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought Dorothy Field, there's a name, there's a person. So I thought I was going to do an American subject, and there's a series of CDs that the Smithsonian put out on the American Songbook, and every month there'd be another CD dedicated to one songwriter, mm-hmm. or sometimes a pair of songwriters. And one day in the mail came a Dorothy Fields album. And there's this face, this wonderful face, just a little bit homely, very Jewish looking. And I looked and I thought, oh, this looks like someone my mother could have played Mahjong with. And I thought, this is my subject.
Wow. And not to mention the fact that, I mean, she's not a well-known name.
No.
And her body of work is absolutely phenomenal. And it's everybody knows her songs. No one knows her.
Well, yes. But, you know, this is the way popular culture is, right? You're very good about saying who wrote your theme music at the end of the show. But our heads are full of sounds, songs, images that we don't know who it belongs to. It's sort of still all folk music in the sense that mm-hmm. we don't know who it belongs to. But now these things are knowable. But we don't need to know her name
to know her music. But the thing is, Irving Berlin, mm-hmm. Jerome mm-hmm. Kern, mm-hmm. all her contemporaries, people mm-hmm. she worked with, are well-known names. Household names to many more people.
Well, two things.
Interesting to me.
Yeah, two things. One is composers' names tend to be known better than lyricists' names. And lyricists' names tend to be known if they've had a lifelong career with a composer,
mm-hmm.
George and Ira Gershwin, Rodgers and Hart, Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Indeed.
She worked mm-hmm. with many different composers, which is one of the things that makes her career very interesting. But you have to want to have the music in front of you that says music by so-and-so, words by so-and-so, to see her name.
Yeah. Well, to tell us about her, let's get into a little bit of the heart of who Dorothy Fields was. Talk to us a little bit about her biography.
Yes, thank you. Love to. First important thing is she's the daughter of a very famous entertainer named Lou Fields. So Lou Fields came to the United States as an immigrant, went through fourth grade, and came up into the world as a comedian, as a part of a team, Weber and Fields. And they did some slapstick comedy, but they did, and this I think is what's very important for her, comedy that had to do with mangling the language.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I don't remember now if they were the ones who did Who Was the Lady Who I Saw You With Last Night. That was no lady, that was my wife. But they performed as people who were coming to this country, who found so many things confusing, including the language. So I think use of language, misuse of language, the funny things about language were always in her household.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think that was a great advantage. On the other hand, the disadvantage was her parents had better things in mind for her. They wanted the family to be upwardly mobile. Her older sister marries a banker. She marries a doctor. The boys go to Columbia. So it's a family of four children. Then finally, three of the four children do get into show business. But she would complain, Dorothy Fields complained. People said, well, if you're so good, why doesn't your father do something for you? And indeed, but the father had a different picture, and the mother had a different picture of their lives. Mm-hmm. And she never went into performing. Her father was a performer, also a producer. But she went behind the scenes, did her two brothers.
Yeah, tell us how Dorothy Fields actually got into songwriting, lyricist, in that era. She was born in 1904. Yes. This is early on in the 20th century.
Well, she gets married when she's 20. She realizes she's now fulfilled her parents' idea, not her idea. It's a time when there's a lot of popular music being published, and she starts, as she calls herself, a $50 a night girl. She goes and they'll hand her a lead sheet, a song, a piece of music. Songs need words. Mm-hmm. And say, so-and-so is going to fly across the ocean. We need a song about that. And the song publishers could afford to take a risk on something that would maybe have currency for a few months. And
that's fascinating to me, that they would write theme songs about what was happening in the culture. Pilots, and you talk about that in your book.
There's a new angel in heaven because Caruso has died. There's a new angel in heaven because Valentino has died. So very current things. Irving Berlin starts with one of his songs is Durando, about somebody who lost an Olympic race. And actually, when we may get to this a little later, many of her lyrics have little bits of topical things that, it turns out, it becomes archaeology. So if she says, we don't have as much fizz as a Seidlitz powder? You're just as hard to land as the Ile de France. These are parts of lyrics of A Fine Romance.
And that was one of her big hits. That was the only song that she actually won an Academy Award for, right?
Not quite. It's a song that appears in the movie Swing Time, which has several wonderful songs in it, A Fine Romance, and Pick Yourself Up, which gives the title to my book. But the song in Swing Time that won an Academy Award is The Way You Look Tonight.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Which is such a wonderful and strange song. It's sung before the romance really gets started, but it's soaked in nostalgia. Lovely. Never, never change. Keep that warm. It's nostalgic even before it begins.
Oh, they're amazing.
They're amazing.
And they are so timely still. That's what's so amazing about her whole body of work.
Well, you know, with the timeliness, it seems to me that even if you don't know the name of the lyricist, they really give you words to form some of your thoughts around, especially for moments when you might feel speechless. When my parents learned I was getting married and I was already in my late 30s, we announced it, and my father said, oh, what a beautiful morning. It was evening, but but there were some words ready-made that were connected to a feeling that he could have.
Yeah. And a lot of her songs are like that. On the Sunny Side of the Street
is one of her big hits. Right. Well, she's a great lyricist of optimism. Although she likes to tell stories about how hard it was for her to break in. You asked me to start about her career, and I haven't gotten past age 20, have I?
But we will.
But On the Sunny Side of the Street, and pick yourself up. And even the ones that could have been said, like, I can't give you anything but love, baby. That's the only thing I have plenty of, baby.
Yeah, indeed. That's amazing. You know what? I want to also talk about the fact that she in some ways got her apprenticeship by writing songs for the Cotton Club in Harlem.
Yes.
Tell us about that. I mean, one of the first people that actually, she says, influenced her was McHugh.
Jimmy McHugh, who she had a partnership with for 6 or 8 years and wrote many of her best-known songs with him. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll back up a little and say her two brothers went to Columbia, and the younger one, Herbert, did lots of varsity shows with his fellow Columbia people, which included Rodgers and Hart and Hammerstein. And she never went to college, and this was a door that was not open to her. But she cleverly found a back door, or another door, a side door. Uh-huh. So she had been sent giving lyrics to Mills Music. The music manager was a man named Jimmy McHugh, and they got an invitation to write songs for the Cotton Club. The Cotton Club is a speakeasy up in Harlem that was famous in the 20s and 30s and famous for wonderful musicians, Duke Ellington, Cab Calloway, Lena Horne later. When McHugh and Fields left the Cotton Club, they were replaced by Harold Arlen. So it was a great place for new music, and it allowed people in New York to have two transgressive activities at once. They could go and drink booze, which was illegal in the 20s, and look at black people. And it was a very interesting beginning because, and this is, I think, a part of what it takes to understand Dorothy Fields, she's always writing a little bit through a mask. So that unlike the singer-songwriters of today, some of whom are writing confessional music, she's writing things to put in other people's mouths. Black women, black men, Fred Astaire, Lily Pons, a wide range of people. So the music, although they say something about her, they're always a little bit filtered because they're meant to be sung by another person or character. And person or character means at first when she's writing for the Cotton Club, she's writing sort of reviews. And then the next several things she does on Broadway are reviews. So you're not interested in the character.
Mm-hmm. Did you think this enabled her to have some kind of detachment? Have people said they didn't think her songs attributed at all to anybody knowing what her biography was?
I don't know. I think she had a great skill for detachment, so that many of the songs she writes, the ones that are love lyrics, are detached or distrustful or sort of, I don't know about this, so don't blame me for falling in love.
So she was realistic in some ways.
I think so. I think so, definitely.
I mean, there was a lot of divorce in her family as well.
Oh, well, her parents, of course, stayed together. She divorced her first husband, her older brother. Oh, no, and the brothers, yeah, the younger people all divorced, except for Herbert, who never married. So I think she was very realistic about it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Charlotte Greenspan. We're talking about her book, Pick Yourself Up, Dorothy Fields and the American Musical. Now, you know, before we do run out of time, I want to talk about the fact that eventually, after the Depression, Broadway started going black, and a lot of these people, including Dorothy Fields, ended up going to California, going to Hollywood. To tell us a little bit about her life when she went to Hollywood.
Well, it was a wonderful life through the 30s, pretty much. Not only she went to Hollywood, her two brothers went to Hollywood, her mother and father went to Hollywood. They were all well-employed. They had a house, swimming pool, tennis courts, many cars.
The whole stereotype of a Hollywood life.
Absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think it was glorious for a while, except when you're working in Hollywood, you're a paid employee. And to some extent you do, or to some extent you don't get much respect. But in any case, you have much less control over the product.
And they were writing theme songs for films and so on. I mean, then this was a transition from writing for Broadway and reviews to writing for film, a lot of it.
So they were writing also theme songs, but also for characters, which I think Dorothy Fields felt was a sort of privilege, was a great treat. And so that when she goes back to Broadway in the 40s, she starts writing for characters in a way that's filled with understanding. So it's not only a good song, exactly like you, but it's a song that reveals the person. So, and in the 40s, in the 50s, in the 60s, the characters she gets interested in more and more are independent women who go after what they want.
Exactly. And it also probably has to do with her biography.
Indeed.
We were talking about she probably became deeper, got to know herself better as she grew older, too.
I think so.
While these songs were developing.
You know, it's funny because now that the book is done and I'm talking about it, like with you right now, mm-hmm. I feel like I'm getting to know her better. Because I'm mulling it over more, and I'm thinking about it more. But she starts being not interested in ingenues, not interested in innocence. A musical like A Tree Grows in Brooklyn.
Which is one she did.
Which is mm-hmm. one she did, yes, with Arthur Schwartz writing mm-hmm. the music. The character who runs away with the show is not the young girl growing up who's central to the novel, and not even so much the romantic pair. It's an aunt. But it's an aunt who's had experience, it has a kind of philosophy, and she was played by Shirley Booth, just ran
incredibly famous at that
yes.
time.
Yes,
a lot
yeah.
of people probably don't know that, yeah.
Yeah, and then the last two plays she did, Sweet Charity and Seesaw, are really rather dark. These are not only experienced women, but these are women who are going to be left.
Mm-hmm. And let's also mention that she did Annie Get Your Gun.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
that was a huge... And her brother even wrote the book for that.
Well, only wrote the book for that.
They only wrote the book for that.
That is.
That's correct.
The original plan was she and Herbert would do book, she would do lyrics with Jerome Kern. Jerome Kern, sadly, died, you know, just collapsed on the street. Done.
Yeah.
It was the idea of Annie Get Your Gun was still a good idea, and they had Ethel Merman, I think, lined up. And so it was a sort of, all right, now what? And the person they found to fill the gap was Irving Berlin.
Just a little minor character in American musicals.
And they courted him. Oh, they courted him up and down the street. Rodgers wrote because Rodgers and Hammerstein produced. And Hammerstein told him how wonderful it would be, and they try to get rid of all of his worries. Berlin had been very active during World War II,
mm-hmm.
And he was exhausted.
Well, he didn't like the book that much either, did he, at first?
No, I think he found that the book gave a lot to him. But he said, you know, the times I've written book musicals rather than reviews, Berlin said, not so good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Hammerstein said, the book will really help you. And the book indeed did and gave him titles. And it was, of course, perhaps their greatest success, everybody. And he showed his appreciation in a curious way, or a nice way. That is, normally you split the profits, third for the book writer, third for the lyricist, third for the composer. And Berlin, I think it's something like that. And Berlin mm-hmm. being both the composer and the lyricist, because Berlin always writes his own lyrics from his earliest time, would have gotten 2/3, Dorothy and Herbert would have gotten 1/3, but he said, nah, let's split it 50-50.
Because she helped him so much with his ideas. That was an amazing thing in the book, I thought.
And
quite
and
gracious and
very
unheard
gracious.
Of.
And Berlin was a shrewd financial operator,
uh-huh.
but he did that.
Did you find during some of your research on Dorothy Fields that she knew that she was a pioneer and forging the way for other women? Did she have any idea that was going to be her role to us?
I think not, because I don't think she saw herself as a pioneer. I think that it was really an almost Victorian sense of, I will work hard and do good work and present my work, and that's that. And it wasn't a pioneer for everybody. I'll tell you a story which is a little sad, a little interesting. In one of Dorrie Previn's memoirs, Dorrie Previn was out in Hollywood. She wanted to become a lyricist, and she went to speak to Vernon Duke. And Vernon Duke says, there are no women lyricists. And Dorrie Previn said, what do you mean? There's Dorothy Fields. And Vernon Duke says, there's only one Dorothy Fields.
Wow.
But in fact, there isn't only one. I mean, there's Betty Comden and there's Carolyn Lee and many more now. But I think although she's in general kindly to people coming up, and Fred Ebb has said how helpful she was, I don't think she ever saw herself waving a banner. Although, maybe for the Girl Scouts. That was one of the charities that Ellen Berlin got her interested in. But no, I don't think she saw her work as political.
That's interesting, too. I mean, we obviously have turned her into a sort of a
sure,
feminist figure
absolutely.
You know, the pioneer of women.
But I think she doesn't see it political any more than she sees it. There's a very good book by Andrea Most about musicals and Jews making musicals. And I don't think she saw herself necessarily as the Jewish pioneer either, although a lot of that happened.
Yeah, a lot of people thought of her as. Yeah, yeah. Well, what were some of her favorite songs that she wrote? Did she ever talk about that?
Ah, well, you know, in 1972, so this is...
A couple years before she died.
Mm-hmm. There was a series at the 92nd Street Y called Lyrics and Lyricists. And that series, you can get a CD of this now. And she selected several of her favorite songs. And some of her favorite songs are indeed the most popular ones. I can't give you anything but love, baby. Oh, I should have brought the CD with me. I could have read the titles off the back.
That's okay. People can go to your book, and you have an extensive compilation of all of her famous works.
Well, actually, at least a list of all of her works, of everything known.
Yeah, of all of her works.
Yeah.
I think of most of her stuff as famous. It's an amazing body of work that she left us.
Yes, it's an amazing body of work, both for quantity and for quality. And for its staying power, I guess one should say, I was alone in New York reading in a restaurant. I was doing some research in the Museum of Radio and Television. And, you know, her songs come on in the restaurant, and her songs are they're with us. And now, in a sense, in some ways even more available on YouTube. And the CDs are available. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they're very much with us.
You know, but before we run out of time, I want to know how you did research on this. Because, I mean, she must still have family members that are still living. Did you get to interview members of her family? And what is her legacy to them?
Ah, that's very interesting. And actually, not the cheeriest story. She has a son and a daughter. When I first wanted to start working on the book, I got their phone numbers because they have the copyrights, you see.
That's what I was saying.
So if you go to Library of Congress and you look up the copyrights, you can see who are the copyright holders. You can learn there's a living son and daughter, and there's addresses and phone numbers. And I contacted them and the daughter, Eliza, who is a fabric artist mainly, does, you know, sort of quilt-like things, called me right back, and we talked, and she lives in Pennsylvania, not far from Binghamton.
Wow.
And we met, and we've had meals, and we've talked to one another, and she helped me get the birth certificate, because I don't think anybody can just go to Department of Records and get... So she was wonderful and helpful. The son, who is a musician, and does cabarets, and has cut records, and is a vocal coach... was not at all helpful, and in fact, hostile.
Really? Tell our listeners what their names are.
Well, Dorothy Fields' second marriage was to a man named David Eli Lam, or possibly Eli David Lam. So the family name is Lam, and it's Eliza and David.
Mm-hmm.
And David you can find on Google. I don't know if Eliza
Why do you think he didn't want to help you with his mother's legacy? That's amazing to me.
Well, the first thing he wrote back is he said... Lots of people say they want to write about my mother, but they never do. And I don't think... So send me some of your work. And so I sent him something, and he said, no, you're not the right person to do it. And I thought, would have been nice to have help, but I'll do an end run around it. I mean, he doesn't have the say about whether or not I can do the work. So I worked on this for years and years and years, and I thought I would do an end run when it came to copyright and just get copyright from publishers.
Mm.
But the some of the publishers wanted $150 a song. And then finally, and some of them said, no, we have to check with the son. And I sent him the manuscript. He said, oh, yes, it's pretty good. Let me work with you on it. We worked for almost a year. And
wow.
I said, He made a million changes in word order and this and that. He caught some errors. And then I said, okay, I'm ready to send this to Oxford, and I will send you a copy of what I'm sending. And he said, no, you're not ready yet. We can make this book much better. And besides, you haven't put in all of the other comments I made.
Wow.
I said, no, I'm ready. And he finally said, I will do everything in my power to stop this book. And his power was not great enough to stop the book, but we had to take all the lyrics out. I had to rewrite everything again because the lyrics had to go out.
So he has the where was the daughter? But the daughter does as well. I wonder if they were having disputes about that.
They're not great friends, but they're certainly not enemies. And it was not my business as the author to say, come on, side with me against him. And she said to me, you know, David's a control freak.
So this is a semi-authorized biography of Dorothy Fields, right? I mean,
this is a true and accurate biography.
But it wasn't authorized by some of her family, though.
Yeah, and more to the point, I could not publish the lyrics. And, you know, it harms the book, and it certainly harms, you know, it doesn't help the reader.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it helps David, but...
I mean, luckily, Dorothy Fields' songs are so well-known.
Yes.
I mean,
I was even
sitting there while I was reading the book, humming them, going, oh, my gosh.
Yes.
I have no idea that a woman wrote these. That's another thing. We only have a couple minutes left. A lot of people try to have debates about whether her music was feminine or from a woman's perspective, but it seems to me not.
Thank you. It seems to me not also. That is... Again, because she's writing for other people to sing. Philip Fourier thinks she's more at ease with sexual things than a man would be. But I think it's so hard to type men, type women. I think aspects of her life come through. And particularly, as I said, in the kind of characters she gets interested in writing for. But, you know, this argument goes on also with things without words, with music. Can you tell that this is by Fanny Mendelssohn and this is by Felix Mendelssohn?
Yeah.
Well, no. Even Queen Victoria, who loved the music, was congratulating Felix, and Felix writes and says, you know, it was your piece.
So I would say Dorothy Fields just wrote for all of us.
Oh,
I mean,
absolutely.
Her yes. body of work resonates with all of us.
I think so.
I would say.
I think so.
What are you working on now? And anything else coming from Charlotte Greenspan?
Yes. The next thing I want to do is a book about film biographies of composers.
Films that were made about their lives.
Yes, right.
I understand.
Both interested in the kind of myths that get... around there's myth and there's business because it's film, but also there's a selection of composers. You can do a film about Stravinsky because he knew Coco Chanel. Would you do a film about Schoenberg? So how you select them, and then how is the music presented? And because it's all wrapped up with time, music takes a certain amount of time.
And a lot of those films do become part of our cultural memory of some
of
these people. Absolutely.
Yeah, again, it's a little bit going back to my past. I mean, I knew about Chopin because of a film biography of Chopin.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the next book, I hope.
Well, we will look forward to that. Charlotte Greenspan, it has been an absolute pleasure. Go out and get her book, Pick Yourself Up, Dorothy Fields and the American Musical. It's fascinating. It tells you about your country, your culture, and our past. Thank you very much, Charlotte.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.